guest today in the science studio is Susan Greenfield, more properly Professor, Baroness Susan Greenfield, Professor of Synaptic Pharmacology at the University of Oxford, but more importantly, the Director of the Royal Institution, which is one of England's premier institutions for getting out public understanding of science. Susan's in the United States. She has a new book out called The Quest for Identity in the 21st Century, and it's caused a certain furore, I must say. Mm-hmm. I was watching some of the interviews on BBC Newsnight, and I've been reading some of the headlines about whether screen-based media changes our mm-hmm. brains, screen culture and so on, people of the book versus people of the screen and so on. Why do you think this has had such a huge effect?
I think a good analogy might be perhaps when people first started to suggest that smoking and lung cancer could be linked. The last thing you want, if on the one hand you're enjoying yourself doing something and on the other hand you're making a lot of money out of it, the last thing you want is someone to come along and say there might be a problem here. This furore that you allude to has often been based on a misunderstanding of what I actually said. And the original speech, which was made in the House of Lords in the middle of February, clearly just outlines a very simple syllogism, which is that we know that brains are very sensitive to the environment. Unquestionably, the environment is changing. Kids nowadays are spending 6 hours a day more in front of a screen. And therefore, if the brain is sensitive to the environment and if the environment is changing in unprecedented ways, then it follows the brain might, and I stress might, be changing in unprecedented ways. And the reason people feel so angry suggests that there may be perhaps an element of reality there for them, an element of truth. If I said to you, the earth is flat, you wouldn't get angry, it wouldn't be a furore, you'd just feel rather sorry for me, you'd take me aside, you'd explain where I was wrong. But the fact that people seem so hostile, based on the misunderstanding that I've said it's bad in the first place, I think suggests to me that there is a debate to be had and experiments to be done, and perhaps regulation to be introduced.
Well, now you say didn't say it was bad. The one of the talks you gave recently, which I was at, mm-hmm. you showed something from a British newspaper, which showed, and I'm going to get the figures approximately mm-hmm. here, that between the 10th and the 11th birthday, a child is in school for about 900 hours.
That's right. Yeah.
With the family for about 1,300 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And watching a screen of some kind for almost 2,000
hours. That's right. Yeah.
Now, question is that just the way technology has gone, just the way things are? Because one of your critics said, well, you know, this is all we're talking about here, he said, after you gave your speech mm-hmm. at the Royal Institution, is that there's always been simulations. I mean, fiction is simulation, Shakespeare is a simulation, and so on and so forth. This is just high bandwidth simulation, nothing wrong with it.
We'll have more than one detractor, of course.
Yeah.
I think in the Vanguard we have this guy Ben Goldacre, who to the best of my knowledge, has based a lot of his criticism on the idea that I've said screen technologies are bad, and I've never said that.
Right.
But we'll leave that to one side, because why spoil a good story if you can actually enhance or exaggerate what you think someone said? So.
The other thing, just to conclude that, the person also said, what's the difference between now
mm-hmm.
and aren't we just being sort of technophobes?
Mm-hmm.
What's the difference between now and somebody in Victorian times or earlier saying, get your nose out of that book, go and do something worthwhile?
Okay, well, both those statements you've made are really related. One is saying that being engrossed in a book for a long period of time is as bad as playing computer games, and the other is saying that books and screens are the same type of experience. Now, let's just think about that, because I don't think that argument really stacks up. When you read a book, you go on a journey, and you go from the beginning, usually, to the middle, to the end. You don't randomly access the book unless it's a dictionary or something like that. Most typically, when you read a book, the notion is that there is a narrative there, and you are led by the author, the authority, who takes you by the hand and therefore leads you through a sequence of steps, logical steps or quasi-logical steps. Well, it is unidirectional. You can't go the opposite way, because the sequence, the narrative, is very important. Now, it might be a journey that you don't enjoy or that you don't like, but it is a journey nonetheless, and intellectually you end up in a different place from where you started.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens is, the human brain being what it is, you then evaluate that journey in terms of previous journeys you've made, previous books you've read, and previous experiences you've had in the three-dimensional world. So that gradually, in this world in which you normally live, where actions have consequences, where there is a certain sense of a single direction in which you're travelling, then gradually you build up a conceptual framework in which you evaluate the subsequent books, the subsequent events, so you can, if you like, check them off against the checks and balances of the adult mind. Now, that is very different from being in a world that has no consequences, where the emphasis is on the experience rather than by the logical sequence of a past, a present, and a future. And what I've said rather glibly, and I think nonetheless it captures the difference, is when you play a computer game to rescue the princess, you don't care about the princess. But when you read a book, you do so because you care about the characters, you care about the princess. And when you say you care about someone, it's because she or he means something to you, which is why you're following their fortunes in the book. And the fact that they mean something to you is because you can actually place them in a context where they relate to other associations. Now, if you're in a world that's stripped of any cognitive content, where the premium is on strong stimulation of the senses, that can be very nice. We all do it. We all go dancing. We like skiing, some of us. I'm sure most people like sex and fine food and music and so on. So I'm not disparaging choosing that kind of experience, that hedonistic, sensational experience from time to time. But we also counterbalance that with the cognitive experience, a world where we do think, hence the term, where thinking does entail a sequence of logical or quasi-logical steps. So I think it doesn't really get past Hosford Base to think that books and screens are the same thing. They serve different purposes, they provide different experiences, and they rehearse different mental abilities.
Now, your critics are incensed by the fact that you take this a step further, or at least suggest the possibility of a step further. You are actually quite careful in your words, but nevertheless, you do say, here's this stimulation coming at you all the time, hours and hours a day, young brain, highly impressionable. Mm-hmm. Is it any surprise, or is it, what is there a correlation between the fact we have this huge increase, the number of people with ADHD, attention disorders, deficit disorders, and increasing prescriptions for Ritalin, and so on and so forth? Does that have anything to do with screen life?
Well, there's certainly correlation, because that's what correlation is. It's when there's two things happening, whether they're related to each other, whether there's a causal link. I'm merely suggesting that we should perhaps explore that, because we do know that the human brain is very sensitive to the environment. And if that environment, especially for very young children, is one where the attention spans are very short, where a screen experience mandates a short attention span, where you press a button, something happens, you press a button, something happens in rapid succession, that can actually be in itself very addictive and exciting, to have an instant feedback. If you're then placed in a world where you have to sit still for 20 minutes or half an hour, it may just be that you would fidget a bit, and then people would say that you had an attentional issue. So I think it's the kind of information we need to attain. We need to really explore this, because heavens, it is too important to be complacent. And what annoys me about some of the critics is that they don't know any better than I that something is or isn't the case. Assuming something is not the case just because it's convenient to do so is, I think, selling the next generation down the river.
Could you explain a little expansion of this, which I saw in the British press? I don't know if it's it's widespread here or not, but my understanding is that to keep up with technology, it's now part of the curriculum in English schools to be to actually keep up with these technologies. Yeah. And there was a piece I read that where you were complaining about the Twittericulum.
Yeah, well, the latest report suggests that young primary school children, kindergarten children, should learn Google. Now, what they omit is to actually suggest what they might be Googling on. And I think we've got ourselves a bit back to front in that to have people up to speed with technology begs the question what you're going to use the technology for. And I think that we shouldn't be saying this is a society with a certain technology, therefore we have to fit in with it. Surely we should say, what do we want our young people to learn? What do we want them to be? And then harness that technology to deliver what we want, rather than the other way around. We don't want the tail wagging the dog.
People seem to have survived, though. I mean, these transitions of new technologies coming in the past. Is it, you're not content to just sort of say, well, let's see what happens?
I think let's see what happens is a very dangerous attitude to take when it comes to the next generation and it comes to our whole society. I don't think people, when they were first worrying about smoking and lung cancer, or indeed about global warming, would have been very persuasive if they just said, let's see what happens, and shrugged. It's too important and expensive an experiment to make to just see what happens. In the past, the technologies have driven and been part of the culture. They haven't been a culture all of their own. Mm-hmm. So, for example, I'm old enough to remember the introduction of television, certainly in the UK, which probably inevitably lagged behind the US. But we had one television in our home, and being my family, we talked all the time anyway while watching it, perhaps like many. But the television, in a sense, was the latest advance over and above the Victorian piano. It's something that actually was the centre of attention, but it facilitated interaction and discussion and a family evening together rather than being a culture all on its own, whereas nowadays you have someone going up to their room alone and sitting there communing with a screen alone. Never before have human beings in the 100,000 years we've stalked the planet used the precious free time they have. And heavens, we have more than any other generation because technology has given us a longer life and freed us up from drudgery. Never before in any culture, to the best of my knowledge, has any human being chosen to spend their premium time alone playing a game that means nothing and teaches them nothing, benefits them in no way whatsoever, other than by delivering a here and now experience. Only very small children do this usually. And normally by the time you develop and grow and mature, yes, you might play a game because it's a vehicle for social interaction, charades on a Christmas day. You might play games because you want to get fit, but it's or because there's some ulterior motive, team bonding, this kind of thing. But very rare to play a game all alone and the game means nothing. And when you have finished the game, guess what? You can just play it again and again and again, and it has no consequences at all. And you just start from zero again and play the game again. It's meaningless. You've spent your hour or your 2 hours in an activity that has had no forward narrative, had no consequences to it. Now, it may be that we choose that, but I think given the impressive cultural explosion that we've seen over the centuries that human beings have been capable of, what a waste. If, ironically, technology is delivering all this free time and leisure and longer life, and at the same time really limiting us to just being small children.
So you think this is, I mean, this is near, I can see that the irony of this irritates you. I mean, I
think more than irritates, you know, it's more, depresses. I think it's rather tragic, actually.
So there's an infantilization of the mind, if that's such a word. There's this mental masturbation going on, essentially. And instead of Second Life, you're saying get a life.
let's be clear about the screen activities that we're referring to. Although there's certain overlap, I think one can nonetheless think and talk in separate breaths about Second Life. And I'm sure everyone watching this knows what Second Life is. Although surprisingly, when I've given talks recently, there are people within the audience, the majority who still don't quite know what it is. But as everyone knows, Second Life is not a computer game. It is, as its name suggests, a cyber life where you can be a wasp waste, I don't know, Vlad the Dragon's Lair or something like this, where you can have whole economies in a virtual world. So there's that offering, experience offers you a second identity as opposed to a game, as opposed to social networking sites. And I think the three activities clearly have different issues or different emphasis that one would want to explore and discuss. So whilst on the one hand you can do a little bit of an umbrella overview of all three, it may be some of the issues that one of those activities raises doesn't necessarily apply so forcefully to the other.
Okay, so you actually did try a Twitter account at one point.
I didn't,
you
didn't? Never.
Was that somebody faked it on your behalf?
I never have.
It must be. So
You see, it's scary, isn't it, what people do?
Here's one small possible counter-argument. Today's Guardian in the UK, the editorial actually says, Twitter, tweet nothings. You want to know what happened over the weekend? Well, Barack Obama reportedly wants direct pre-election talks with Iran. Microsoft's about to launch a new search engine. Elizabeth Taylor tried to smuggle a new puppy into the hospital. There's a lot of these things here. And their basic argument is that actually a space is emerging in which people can communicate with each other based on mutual interests. There's almost a McLuhan-esque endorsement of this. It's a global village. And that the 140 characters can be made to have some effective force. I mean, do you buy that? Okay,
no, let's just think about that. How sad that, you know, a species that previously wrote novels and expressed themselves in 1,000-word letters are now having to encapsulate important or interesting ideas in 150 characters, and that's the first issue. And if you are used to doing that, are you going to start living your life in windows of 150 characters? And I do find that rather sad. Secondly, there's many ways in which you can have debates and discussions. You can go to the pub. You can go out into the street. You know, you can go to universities. You can come to the Royal Institution in London. There's many, many places and ways in which you can discuss ideas with each other. You can go and sit in the piazza, and like people have done for generation after generation, in three dimensions, and discuss and explore. And so to say that this is the only vehicle for debate and discussion of people who are ordinary human beings who aren't in positions of power, don't have the normal platforms that politicians have, I find that a bit disingenuous. Yeah. Secondly, if you just have a readout of information like this, out of context, then one does question the value of it. Yeah? So information is not knowledge, and we shouldn't confuse the two. The fact you can access information, even in 150 characters, is only the first step. If you don't have a conceptual framework in which to place it, or if you have no other facts to which it should relate, then actually I would question how it's going to help you or give you any insights into anything. You're just going to say, wow, Elizabeth Taylor smuggled a puppy in far out and then press on. Is this really very valuable, truly? So I think that I don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. Look at MIT, who've put all their courses on the web wonderfully for anyone to access, although they can't register. Of course, it can be a very powerful and useful and fantastic way of disseminating information. But you can't assume that the passive receiver is already up and ready with their conceptual framework and their Renaissance mind to then appreciate what the fact is, and more that they can then, in a limited space, actually discuss and debate it. So I think that on the one hand, yes, the technologies are very valuable, and I'm never saying they should, you know, be abolished any more than you should abolish chocolate. But you wouldn't recommend doing nothing else other than eating chocolate. You'd recommend having a healthy, balanced diet, of which chocolate was a very small but interesting and fun part. Yeah. So I'm not saying you shouldn't do Twitter, but to just do that, to rely on that for your social interaction, for your sources of information, for your way of thinking about the world, I find totally inadequate.
Just cut to a couple of other things for the time being. One of the things that I keep on getting asked is, how do you get to be a baroness? What does it mean? Does she have lots of land?
So, oh, well, I wish. Just, I've been just
for a general audience, would you just mind unpacking that?
Okay, well, we have to go back in history a little bit. The way the government of the UK is organised is into two chambers, like other countries now, where we have the House of Commons, the elected democratic chamber, and the House of Lords, which up until 1958 was composed of so-called hereditary peers, that is to say, for want of a better word, nobles, who traditionally would have owned land, although that's not a prerequisite, some don't anymore, but who do inherit a title of one sort or another, whether it's baron or earl or duke, from their father. And after 1958, because it was shown that the majority of these folk, perhaps not surprisingly, were Tories, were rather right-wing, the government brought in a system whereby you could have a much more balanced representation in the House of Lords, by a system called life peerages. And these were traditionally emeritus politicians who'd served with great distinction, who were nominated by their party to serve in the House of Lords, and therefore one could actually restore the balance a little bit of our right and left-wing parties, our Labour and Tory party. When Blair came to power in 1997, he promised reform of the House of Lords, which is still going on, and it was in 2001 that he introduced this notion, which the press called people's peers, which is actually misleading and led to a great outcry because it suggests that one is randomly selected from people walking the street, folk that could come and actually talk in Parliament. Rather, the idea was to select people who would serve on the crossbenches, that's to say, who would be neither Tory nor Labour, nor Lib Dem, but would serve sitting in the middle, who would be apolitical, who would be able to vote either way. That is to say, they wouldn't, rather strange phrase, take the whip. The whip is where, within a political party, you are told how to vote.
Right.
So if you don't take the whip, it means you can vote as you choose. So the system of these new types of peerages were for people to be for life only, rather like their counterparts in from 1958, but at the same time not political, but to be there to represent certain areas of expertise. In my case, it was science, but there's diplomats and there's military people and so on. There's educationalists there, there's physicians. So we have a rather wide representation now on the crossbenches of we non-political peers. And the way we were selected was for nominations, and then following that, an interview with a cross-party group who grilled us. And then in my own case, I was very, very surprised because there were thousands of people, as you might imagine, up for this, to be one of the first 15 to be selected.
You were in the first batch,
I was in the very first batch, yes.
So, and in fact, a lot of people do come from science. There's in fact, considerable reasonable representation. I mean, I'm thinking of, contradistinction to here, where there's very few scientists.
Well, this is something. When people sneer at our House of Lords, when they say that it's not democratic, we say it depends what element you wish to have in the upper house. If you want it to be a pale imitation of the House of Commons, if the most important thing is that it's elected, then you're going to have to put up with the fact that you might elect people who don't have a wide sweep of expertise. Yes, it will be elected, it will be democratic, but you will get the same kind of composition of expertise as you get in the House of Commons. Mm. Whereas if it is selected, and it has to be completely fair, the selection process, then you can ensure, and I'm very proud to be part of, an institution where there's a very high representative of scientists, for example. So we've had debates on stem cells, and anyone who wished could look, I think it was about a year or two ago, look in Hansard. And there I spoke on the neuroscience and stem cells, other people spoke on regulation, others on the ethics, others on the economics of it. It's been fantastic to have that. I see you've also got a report that has arisen from an all-party group I started on neuroscience and education. So these are ways that one can use the House of Lords as a platform. And indeed, the debate that you've referred to, which caused the furore, was a speech I made in the Lords. And that's what started. I use that as a platform to express my thinking on that.
But a consistent theme here, brain science in the classroom, and that's something that, as you know, we're very concerned with here at the Temple Dynamics and Learning Centre. And it comes under the aegis of the Institute for the Future of the Mind, which is part of the thing that you're associated with at the University of Oxford as well.
That's right,
You're packaging together, you're utilising your science to inform your policy positions.
That's right. Well, my own view is that...
Then you have a platform on the Lords.
My own view is that the 21st century scientist has a duty to the taxpayer and a duty to society to look beyond the ivory tower and look beyond the kind of main concern of most scientists, which is getting a grant. Because although that is important in order to do your own research, at the same time, science is now at the heart of society. As Carl Sagan said, it's suicide to live in a society dependent on science and technology where no one knows anything about science and technology. So what we have to do, whether we like it or not, to the best of our abilities, we scientists, we have to talk to politicians and the press and the general public, because only in that way can the public have a view and be empowered. And that's something I feel very strongly about. And it's very sad when within the scientific community, as indeed this guy Ben Goldacre has said, you know, one shouldn't do this, one should just stick with what you know. And I think that is, again, a very narrow interpretation of what scientists know. What one should do is one should apply what one knows.
Just for clarification, Ben Goldacre is an MD who wrote a book called Bad Science, in which he lambasts a lot of the fluff that gets out under the name of science. Mm-hmm. Criticism of people in positions, public positions, is almost a sport in the media.
Well, can you think of anyone? Can you think of anyone in a public position who has never been criticised, ever? I mean, it doesn't exist. I mean, even the Queen is criticised. You know, so everyone, if you are in public life, if you have a public profile, for want of a better word, of course you are there because you've said something that's different from what other people have said, and not everyone is going to like or agree with what you said. I mean, it's a no-brainer. It follows, obviously, that if you say something different or interesting, then it's going to be challenged, and it's good that it is. What saddens me is when it gets personal, when people, as they say in Australia, play the ball, which you should do, rather than the man. It's when it gets personal or vindictive and spiteful. That's when. And I'm afraid the British press sometimes do that. But so long as you stay on message and discuss the issue being raised, I'm very happy to look people in the eye and defend what I've said. What saddens me is when the criticisms are anonymous or ill-defined, and therefore you can't defend them or talk about them. But it is a healthy society that discusses and debates issues rather than assumes that everything is the case or sneers at people or attacks them or say it does so anonymously. I find that rather cowardly.
Again, a little background question just for an American audience particularly. The press has spent a lot of time looking at your, what they would call your humble origins, not aristocracy at all. Could you just tell us about your parents or stuff like that?
Sure.
Scientists, no.
Well, the press do this because, as you know, everyone loves a good story and it makes a story. So, but my own view is that, fine, yes, my mother was a dancer, my father was an electrician, didn't have much money. But they brought me up in a way that I think I was very privileged compared to a lot of richer people who didn't have the support and the warmth and the encouragement and the confidence building that my parents gave me, and also the values my parents gave me. My parents brought me up to be honest, to be open about things, to say what you think, to look people in the eye, to always own up to things. And these values, I think, are more precious and important than merely having money or owning things. So I do find it rather strange if people think I've done well despite my background. I've done well because of my background. I've had the best education in the UK. I went to one of the top girls' schools in the country and then to Oxford, all for free, of course.
Scholarships.
Yeah, all for free. So I can't pretend that I lived in a cardboard box and, have fought my way up against all the odds. That's not the case. So I just have to just rectify, yes, I come from poor people, but then a lot of people do. But in a sense, that has been a benefit rather than a disadvantage.
Right, but when did you get interested? Why science? Where did science come in?
Science came in late, actually, because no one pointed out to me why it was interesting. And when I first learned about distilling water or the reproduction cycle of the amoeba, no one said why this was relevant or interesting to one's life. No one told me what distilled water was, why it was useful. We just had to stencil conical flasks to show how it was done. Whereas in history and literature, you actually could have ideas of your own, you could have insights, it made you realise and interpret the world around you. And in particular, I chose to do the ancient history and literature. I did classics, Latin and Greek, and ancient history, and indeed maths. That was kind of fun on the side. But my main A-levels, they're the subjects I did at advanced level, 16 to 18, was Latin, Greek, ancient history and pure maths, all of which really gave you a discipline, but not just a discipline in terms of the way you think, but also a context. And that's why I'm very sensitive to this notion of process versus context. Just doing maths was process, whereas comparing ideas of empire, say, in ancient Greece and ancient Rome, was content. You had to see one thing in terms of something else. And that's why comparisons are always very interesting, because you have to compare one thing in terms of something else. And I find that very rewarding and providing great insights. And even though I therefore came to science much later, through philosophy, then psychology, and then neuroscience, which actually has a logical step to it, I don't regret ever having done classics, because that gives you a confidence intellectually that really enables you to engage with new ways of thinking and new ideas and new terms without being scared of them and to just challenge them all the time. So it was really great doing that. And certainly it says a lot also for Oxford, where they put a premium on your enthusiasm rather than what you knew already. I mean, nowadays, sadly, you have to fit into certain boxes and tick certain boxes to qualify for certain things, whereas there was a certain insouciance at Oxford in the 70s when I was there, which where you just gave it a go. And you pushed yourself to your limits. I thought it was great.
So you went to Oxford to read classics?
So the way Oxford entrance used to work, rather like Cambridge, is that after your exams, so-called A-levels when you were 18, you then had to do further exams, entrance exams, afterwards, and then you went up the following year. So I offered, as they say, classics, and I think I'm sort of okay, because at the interview they said, would I consider doing classics? But for me, I already had enough, I thought, in my arrogance, to read Homer in the evenings. Not that I've ever done that, of course. But I was very interested in philosophy. What doing Greek had done had given me an interest in philosophy and asking these very big questions. So I did philosophy, and in Oxford you had to do it with something else. So I did it with psychology, a subject I knew nothing about. It was a very fledgling subject at the time. And actually, in philosophy, which was very abstract and comprised at that time formal logic, which for me wasn't very interesting because I'd done maths. So I found psychology new and interesting. And I suddenly realized with science, you could actually ask questions and test them. And so I did the more physiological options and gradually got more into that. And then my tutor said, I think it'd be a laugh if you were a scientist. And see, that was the attitude of the time, be a laugh, be a hoot. Dispatched me to talk to the then head of pharmacology. And he said, do you know what a millimolar solution is? Now that, in case people, non-scientists are watching, that's the equivalent of saying, have you heard of Shakespeare? Or can you read? You know? And I said, well, I frankly know. And he said, well, never mind, you can tell us about Homer and the coffee breaks. And that was so I said, the whole thing was done, rather like I've been brought up with a sense of having fun, you know, being an individual, not judging people or yourself by what is known and by sanitized little desiccated facts. And so it was a much more dynamic and fluid way of approaching knowledge and information, indeed of life. And for me, I personally thrive on that, and I've enjoyed it hugely. And I find it very sad when people come along in this sort of way of trying to impose constraints and pigeonhole people and things.
We try and knock down silos on Science Network. That's right. It occurs to me now I think about it, that one of the books that I enjoy is a collection of essays called Mind Waves, which has in there essays by Horace Barlow, was here a week ago, and Rodolfo Linas, with whom you studied for a while postdoc. Mm-hmm. But you put that book together, as I recall, with Colin Blakemore, who's obviously a professor of physiology at University of Oxford, or was at one point. Mm-hmm. And Susan Hurley, who was a philosopher.
Yes, sadly now died, wrong, yes. Yeah.
So that's, again,
yes,
the,
that arose.
Mix,
I mean, that's an example. So Susan was a philosopher, and I was having dinner with her one evening, and we were just discussing. We found that although we came at it from different angles, we were both interested in certain things like pain or memory, for example. Mm. They're just two. And so between us, we organised this series. It was very revolutionary at the time in Oxford. It was in the 80s. Between a philosopher and a scientist. And the place was packed every evening, every time we did this. And then the book Mind Waves arose, edited by myself and Colin, as a result of that. And that's what gave me a first taste, actually, for consciousness and interest in consciousness, I think.
You mentioned consciousness. We're in Francis Crick's study. This is the double helix window here.
Yeah.
Francis, obviously, when he came to the Salk from UK, shifted from doing DNA work to consciousness, became his new thing. A lot of that he partnered with on a young scientist called Christoph Koch, with whom you've debated quite frequently.
Yes.
Christoph and Itzhak Fried and Quiroga have done some work recently on trying to find out, as the cover of Discover magazine for June says, can a single neuron recognize Jennifer Aniston? This is the issue that I raised with Horace Barlow a couple of weeks ago, this issue of where in the brain is information stored. Can a single neuron actually do this kind of thing? You have a different view of the brain, I think, from Christoph. Would you like to just...
Yes, the work to which you refer, and it's always hazardous to talk about other people's work when they're not in the room, so with that health warning that I may not be as eloquent or as accurate as they themselves would be, but the idea is that you can record from a single brain cell the electrical discharge, that's to say the activity, of a single brain cell in an awake human being, and it shows a certain selectivity, that's to say it's active only under specific conditions when, for example, Jennifer Aniston or Halle Berry or whoever is presented. Yeah. Now, like much of science, it is not the actual finding that one finds fault with. That's fine, I don't doubt that that is what they saw. The issue lies with the interpretation of that. If the interpretation is that that cell and only that cell will respond in that way, you can only make that claim if you've exhaustively recorded from every single of the other cell in the brain, and that would be impossible to do. So you can't claim an exclusivity of that cell for that particular stimulation. Moreover, you can't claim there's necessarily a monopoly of that particular image for that particular cell unless you present to that cell every single possible image ever in the world, again, impossible. Though you can show variations and show selectivity, as I know they do, you can't say for sure that this cell will only be active to that stimulus, and it is the only cell in the brain that will be active to that stimulus. So both those claims can't be made. So if you can't make those claims, you have to weaken it a little bit and actually probe as to what is it actually telling you. A lot of neuroscience, and I'd include brain imaging in this, as opposed to just looking at isolated brain cells. They're very aesthetic and they're very interesting in and of themselves, and they're formidable in terms of the technology behind them and the skill required. But what they actually tell us, what does it actually tell you? If you have a brain cell that is more active when you present a certain image, what question are you asking there? What is it actually telling you about a particular issue such as consciousness? So although it can claim the front cover and it can be impressive in terms of the technology for doing it, all I do is say, what does it actually mean?
So it would, you have written books on, I think we're almost going to have to say, because of time constraints, that your position is out there in a number of books at this time. But it's a distributed processing kind of view.
Yeah, for those who are interested, especially in my views versus Christoph Cox, in Scientific American in 2007, in October, we have a jointly published debate. So that's perhaps a very straightforward way of finding out in more detail what I'm saying. But my own view is that consciousness is like a dimmer switch. That is to say, you don't have all or none, but it grows as brains grow, and that you as an adult human being, so it's not just an evolutionary issue, but as an adult human being, you will have more or less consciousness at some times rather than at other times. And why I find this idea attractive is that one can actually approach consciousness as something that you measure, which is what scientists like to do. Because if you just have it as a qualitative, ineffable, ill-defined thing, it's very, some people just explain it away or say that it's not there. Others really just sidestep the issue, as in my own view, people like Christoph do when they look at changes in something while the person is persistently conscious, because you're not exploring the difference between consciousness and unconsciousness there. You're looking at changes in consciousness, which I would call attention, which is a very laudable, very worthy thing to do, but it ain't consciousness. So my own view is that whilst at the moment we're still at the foothills of developing this idea that consciousness comes in degrees, that you can have more or less of it, it's something you can measure, what you're measuring and how you measure it and under what conditions, we're only now starting to develop, and that's what we do in my lab and that's what I explore in the books.
Well, so given your family background, the way you grew up, the education that you had, given your view of consciousness and what the brain does, given your view of education, it's hardly surprising, then, I would suggest, that you're not totally enamoured of the Twitterverse, then.
Well, I find it rather sad that we are limiting ourselves to a constant readout of the most banal of activities. Why do we do this? Well, as a scientist, you always say, well, why? Why do people do something? I would say, why do people get angry, for example? They usually, people get angry when they feel threatened or undermined or insecure. That's when you get angry. So people that get angry at my opposition of Twitter, why are they getting angry? Why? What am I saying? It might be that they feel some way threatened, because what I feel with people that seem to need to give a constant online monitoring of the most banal of their activities is that suggests to me a shaky sense of identity. When children are very small, they are constantly demanding attention. They constantly need feedback from the outside world that they're there, that you're actually existing. Whereas normally adult human beings, up until now, haven't needed to do that. You've had a strong sense, internally generated, of your own continuity, your own life story, your own narrative through the world. But to have this constantly read out to some anonymous audience, I find that actually perhaps might suggest that people are feeling less secure about who they are and where they're going. Perhaps they're going nowhere.
I want to ask you about a couple of or more substantive things. There's a couple of questions I always ask people. One of them would be, if you hadn't been a scientist, what else would you have liked to have been?
My mother wanted me to be a dancer because she wanted me to follow in her footsteps.
Or rather, literally.
Yeah, dance in her footsteps. I loved riding horses when I was small. I wanted to be a horse riding instructor. I thought that was the pinnacle of achievement. When I lived in France and I got quite good at French, I thought it would be very useful to be a simultaneous translator, because whilst one wouldn't necessarily want to do that all the time in the pervasive way that one does science and brain sciences all the time, it struck me as intellectually stimulating and a job where once you'd finished, a bit like flying a plane, you didn't have to worry anymore, and that you just sold your services in a very intense, full-on focus way, and then you stopped and did something else. So that, in a sense, had a certain appeal as well. But to be honest, I've never really thought about anything other than doing what I do. But again, I don't see myself as just a scientist. I see myself as me. And I do a whole range of things, ranging from being a trustee of the Alexandrian Library in Egypt, through to being director of the Royal Institution, through to promoting a new charity called Science for Humanity with NGOs and the developing world and scientists, through to being in the Lords, giving the occasional speech, through to the work in my lab, through to making a TV series. So I don't see myself as a this or that. I'm myself. And I think the ideal in life would be to have these portfolio of very different things that one all does for everyone. You know, you do a whole range of different things that interest you that actually complement each other in a way that I find couldn't be served by just one activity. So, for example, high-end science, where you're dealing with difficult concepts that will play out to society decades, not immediately, contrasts with engaging in concepts like refurbishing the Royal Institution, which is not intellectually demanding to understand what that involves, but it's very difficult to actually raise the funds, persuade people and get it all working. So there's various aspects in one's life where they complement. On the one hand, you have intellectual stimulation. On the other hand, you have the reward of seeing something physical change in the outside world. So I think portfolio activities are very attractive and I would like to carry on doing that. I don't see myself as just doing one thing.
If you had a chance to have dinner with anybody in history as well, who would you like to
immediately say? Well, in history, it would be Elizabeth I. It's a great, my role model and heroine. I think nowadays, it would be, I think this is perhaps very unoriginal. I'm sure there'd be a long queue for Obama. And I'm sure they'd say there'd be a long queue for him. I'll join the queue.
Royal Institution importance, hugely important.
The Royal Institution is very important because it's a unique place that has diffused science for common purposes of life. I use the words of our charter for over 200 years. It's proud to be an independent organisation, and therefore I think we get the respect of various sectors, not least the media, because we can host free and fair debates that are not in anyone's pocket, that follow no one's agenda. Not least, I'm very proud that we've had over the last few years a science media centre that is starting to help scientists and journalists speak to each other without pea shooting at each other. So we do many things there, public outreach, young persons programs, a media center, a history of science department, and now we have bar and restaurant and cafe, so we have a salon type environment there. And I'm hoping, as we get further funds, to be able to web stream and webcast everything so it could be truly global, and that every event we have there, and we have 3 or 4 events a week for adults of discussions and debates, could actually be downloaded by anyone anywhere in the world. And I think that would be a wonderful facility. Eventually, I'd like it to be online, where we could have globalization, not just democratization of science.
Women in science. Inevitably, one reads Susan Greenfield, the first woman, this first woman, that first woman. Women in science, is that still, that still appears to be a major issue. I saw a report came out and an editorial in Nature only last week.
Yeah, this is a really serious issue because as you get more senior in science, then it gets harder and the representation of women gets lower. Part of the problem is that when you get to the childbearing age in public sector science, you're on soft money, so-called, you know, 2 or 3 year contracts. And this means that what happens is you'll have time off to have a child, and then it's very hard to come back again at the same level of having have the same publication record as the men against whom you're competing. So either you postpone having children, or you don't have children, or you come back having had children, but at a much more junior level that's very hard to catch up on. So clearly something has to be done. And I work a lot with L'Oréal. I'm part of the jury, so-called, for the UNESCO L'Oréal Prizes, that are international recognition of women on 5 continents, of senior women plus rising stars. But more intimately, I'm involved with the Royal Institution, with L'Oréal. We're now in the 3rd year of fellowships that give a relatively modest sum, but it's a very helpful sum of £15,000 to women to enable them to spend this money on either childcare or equipment or lab assistants or whatever they choose that will help them get back up the greasy pole again. But it's a drop in the ocean, and I can say this year, because we're due for the judging quite soon, for 4 or 5 fellowships, we had over 200 applications. So that tells you something. That tells you that there is a need there, and it's a need that can be addressed. This is not something like black holes. This can be addressed by, for once, throwing money at something, by creating fellowship schemes where anyone who's had primary childcare compete in a ring-fence way, like for like, with, let's say, a 20 or 30% chance of being successful, so it's not like winning the lottery, to get funds for, let's say, 2 years
where you can build up your research career again and develop the ideas again and start to publish again and compete again in the open arena. And I do stress anyone who's had primary childcare, so you could be a widower or a guy who's had custody of children and divorce, something like that. So this is not a sexist issue. It's an issue of people who, just at the accelerated important stage of their science careers, are taken out of the frame to do something else. And I think society cannot afford to lose that amount of talent. We just can't afford it.
Yeah. Just in passing, since you were on the point, you decided not to have, do you miss having, not having children?
That's a strange question, because you don't wake up one morning and say, right, today I'm not going to do something.
Right.
Your life takes certain paths, it evolves in certain ways, and it's not something I really give a lot of thought to any more than I'd give thought to becoming an airline pilot, say. Or, from time to time might think, oh, it would have been interesting.
There's
and
the
I wonder.
Trajectory.
Yeah, so yeah, it's a, you go on your own path.
What's the biggest mistake you ever made, and what did you learn from it?
Someone once said, "Experience is what you get when you don't get what you want." Yeah. So I don't think I've ever made a mistake as such. Perhaps, yes, I suppose talking too freely to the press in my younger days was when I thought that they were all open and honest, and I believed them, so, and they said they wouldn't make a mess, and they would. I'm being glib, but I don't sound too much like Edith Piaf to say I don't regret anything. But there is no point in regrets. And yes, negative things have happened. Perhaps I haven't made the best choice in retrospect in certain things. But then that's all part of life. And if you met someone who'd always made the correct choices, had never put a foot wrong, they wouldn't be very interesting. And I don't think they'd be the full gamut of human person. So, yeah, I've made mistakes, but nothing that I obsess about or would reverse.
Okay, final question. What are you optimistic about?
I'm optimistic about the future in the sense that if we get it right, finally we will have the chance, en masse, to develop our individuality, as opposed to being preoccupied with killing each other or being warm or just surviving. Yeah. I think that technology is giving us lifespans and hours in the day in an unprecedented way to all of us, not just to a privileged few. And I think that it will be a great shame if we trash that and don't make the most of it and don't appreciate it, to become as individual as we can be.
Susan Greenfield, thank you very much.
Thank you.